But I guess it just for a short while. Then he bought a farm. After that, he went out and worked a year or so in the quarries, in the stone shed in Montpelier.
Oh, no kidding.
And he's afraid he's going to catch that lung disease, like, so he quit, come back. And that's when he worked on the stage. I rode with him, I remember one time up to Warren. It was real cold, and they had it on Travis' sled and a pair of horses. They'd take it up there, and it gets cold, it opened the front, and the back is built like a box in there, and had a window on the side where the door was, and that was about it. Go in there, and I had some blankets and straw on the floor, so he had me lay in there and cover up. It must have been about 30 below that night.
Yeah.
And he took the horses after he got done, he took them down in the, left them down there in well, just before you get the old hotels, where the gray building is now, that's where Henry and Betty's lived. And before that, when he was on the farm, before we went to Montpelier, I remember that, see, something I'm going to say and I forgot right now. I do remember riding in a sleigh and it had a buffalo robe. And I probably had the only spring sleigh in town. It had the springs under it. And I think it was just after the war, the Folsoms, I borrowed something from the Wendell Folsom's folks. And I let them have the sleigh, and I guess the barn fell down. I never asked for it back or anything, because I don't know if I'd had theirs or what. I can't remember, but they had that. That's the last that I ever saw that spring sleigh. But and then they used to, and didn't take the hemlock from the mills very seldom, hemlock logs, and they cut them somewhere
they were,
2-3 foot through. And when I first bought the place, there's still a pile of hemlock bark down in the woods. My father said he used to cut that down, peel the bark when it was good, and then they'd take, after it sat there a while, it must have taken over in the wintertime, he didn't say, but they'd load the bark up one day. Next day they'd take it over to Waterbury and come back.
To a tannery, wasn't
it? Yeah, over in Waterbury. And every other day they took a load of hemlock bark over for tanning.
And
he said the only thing to stand up to that, going every other day and then loading up the woods the following day, was the Morgan horses. He said it killed a big team.
No kidding. One of the people I interviewed several years ago was Earl Fuller.
Mm-hmm.
Who also drove the mail?
Yeah, I know. Remember him? Yeah.
Across the mountain, and he talked about how cold it was. And
And when we were still on the farm, I'm jumping back and forth.
That's all right.
We were still on the farm. I was about 5 years old. I remember mother went to Barrie, and John McLaughlin lives where he had what they call a jitney. I remember it was a Dodge car, open turn car, and he lived there where the Irisville Country Store is now. And I remember it was a dollar. I can't remember if it was a dollar both ways or a dollar each way. But he'd take a load of pasture up and up here in the morning and come back at night. And we'd come into Moortown, and where just past the graveyard, where the first bridge was, it was a covered bridge. And we got there and they had it all ripped up. So what they did, they laid some planks down, made all the passengers walk across the bridge on the plank, and then they hitched that car across. Everybody was giving them directions and stuff. And he drove that, got the cross. I remember, I remember it was a Dodge car.
Gosh.
And he drove that across and went to Pier. And later on, I think he went and bought Buick, had a big Buick. He did the stuff in there. So he usually had a pretty good load with people going to Montpelier and that.
Gosh.
You probably used to claim with a good trotting horse, you'd leave Waitsfield, an hour later you'd be in Montpelier. Let the horse rest 3-4 hours, and do whatever you had to do and come back. You'd come back an hour with a good trotting horse. Well, I wonder how much better they do today. And that was dirt roads and stuff. Of course, they do it a lot less than an hour, say 20 minutes. But with all the difference in the road and the roads straightened out.
Well, when I talked with Alden Bettis, he was talking about the roads, and because he drove the milk truck,
yeah.
And gosh, he talked about winching himself out and all the problems he had with the roads.
Well, when we were first up here, first couple of years, so it must have been about 1950, I started shipping little milk. I didn't have many cattle. I was trying to raise young cattle and that build up a herd. I was up here for 4 days, and then the night, the fourth day, they hadn't been around. And the snow was deep in the roads, just low here. It used to drift 6 to 8 feet deep or more. I took a horse and a sleigh, it was an old sleigh we had then. I went down through, however I could find it was down. Drifted towards, was it deep. Here, go down to the first place above the hill, down through the field there, went down number 9 hill, got down to George Sawyer's. They lived across the, from the Millbrook Lodge. He was hauling milk. I got down there and unloading the milk, and I heard the plow. I had to call a tractor. They were coming down number 9. That's 4 days to get plowed out. And just a few years ago, I was too lazy to put chains on, so I went, they're all over the hill here. So I started to go up around the vases, around the other way, and it was all over the hill there. So I just pulled out, figured out it would be along the snowplow. Someone was sputtering, she says, when are they going to be here? She said, I've been here about 20 minutes. She said, when are they coming around that plow? I said, well, they've got a lot of roads to plow. And I said, they'll be along a little while. I said, that they've got a lot of roads before they get here. It wasn't more than 15 minutes afterwards they come along the plow, and up, and I follow them right up through, and they carry them all over the road. And that was what used to burn me up when they first come here. If they couldn't make the hill, I've had them come timed again. Instead of letting a person by and his back of them, they'd pull out into the middle of the road and pop me off.
Mm-hmm.
They did that one night, and I was going uphill, and some young fellows coming down, it's daylight. I had room enough to go by, and they're outside the road before I told them they pulled right out in the middle of the road and stopped me. They heard about it.
Is that her again?
I won't repeat what I had to say. So another time we went up and had to live with me, and I had two children. I still have cattle, and I had a couple 300 grain in the car. Get up and the last drive on the before we got top of the hill there. I was going wrong, didn't have any trouble on the car wheeler out from me, and I slammed brakes on a stop. And I was burned up, my back didn't drive, and I got stuck. So I was bad, I didn't back in the driveway quite straight. So they got back down in the meantime, and I tried to pull ahead. There was just about room for a car to go by. I got out the shovel, and they went clear down the foot of the hill, come up. They got up to me, and they said, they didn't quite dare go by. So they backed down and come up again. I think I did it 2 or 3 times. And the last time I got out, I got straightened in the road, and they got up part way, and they stopped back down. And I loaded everybody in the back seat, and I started right up hard, had to stop, and I felt a lot better. They tried 4 or 5 times to make that hill, because they blocked me off. But that's what someone would do when they first come around here. They couldn't make it. They figured I was going to slip them, I guess, and I'd be going along all right.
Well, as Otis Wallace said, they came with a different set of values and different set
entirely.
Of ideas, mm-hmm. And
what they ended up bringing up what they wanted to get away from.
Yeah, we have more crime than that in the valley here in 1 week. We used to have all year.
Well, my kids and I won't even let their kids hike up the hill anymore alone.
Our kids did.
Think nothing of it.
But they used to, first, second grade, for the first, they used to hike all the way up, and then they got where they would come around and pick them up. And George Boyce, it's too bad you didn't know him.
He was a nice fellow.
Yeah. He come around in the Jeep, started carrying them in the Jeep. And the teaching entirely different today. We had the Geneva House, Ms. Delmorton. She might be able to tell you a lot about the schools and stuff in the valley here.
Geneva?
Howell, up on the Howell farm up toward Moortown Common. They got a farm there. And
darn good teacher.
And she taught, she must have had about 30 pupils, all 8 grades. and they come out better education than they get today. Today,
just a little one room school right,
right down the foot of the hill.
Number 9 down here.
Or they call early. They had, well, they had two rooms, but they just one teacher at that time. Back when Stern probably tell you, when he went, I think they had, I think he said one time they had 45 pupils in the two rooms.
Did you go down there?
No, happily, my folks live in Wastefield every time, or that was the way. 6 years out in Toledo, in Ohio. And
did you grow up here?
I grew up on the other side of town, North Vista.
North Vista.
She went, yeah, she went over there. Her,
I was born over there. Went to school
over
there.
She used to hike 3-4 miles to school every day.
Now, was your name, you said that you were Mr. Nelson's...
Yeah, my name was Nelson.
And so, that they had a farm in North Vaston?
Well, they tried to get a farm, but they ended up losing it, you know. Times were hard, so he went down, lived on his father's place, and farmed down there for him.
Where in...
That farm's gone now.
Yeah, that was in North Vaston, just down the hill from where my dad tried to get started.
Just below the graveyard there, it's all gone now. The barn on one side of the road and the house and the other, everything's gone. You
don't even, I don't, can't even maybe they can pick find out the where the house used to be anymore.
And did your grandfather first come here from somewhere else?
I have no idea what his history was. Because, you know, they didn't talk back and forth too much, you know, so.
Another thing, this ethnic thing they have nowadays, I remember my uncles used to love, they used to brag about being the Irish, having Irish blood. They'd brag about that, but they'd love to turn around and tell Irish jokes on themselves, and they got a big kick out of it. I remember my uncle was a contractor, he moved up next to my father, he's the next youngest. He went out to Lidl years ago and was a small contractor. And I remember one he used to love to tell about the Pat and Mike. He said one of them come over to the States here, got a job. And Pat wrote back, he says, Mike, get over here as soon as you can. He says, I got a beautiful job. He says, big pay. And he says, get over here as soon as you can. He says, all I have to do is to carry a hod of brick up 14 stories, the man up there does all the work. Uncle's a contractor, and he loved to tell that joke. Well, I told that to some fellow, and he said, well, a while ago, and he said, well, he says something about he being Irish, he didn't like it. I said, well, I said, I've got Irish thing too, and I says, I said, my uncles used to love to tell the jokes on themselves, and that's the way with all of them. And now that they're all insulted.
Super sensitive.
Yeah, you know, look at the, like over here, they call it Marshfield Pond now. The big controversy a few years ago about it being called Niggerhead Pond. And they were all insulted. I said, well, they should have thought of, looked at it a different way. I says, Niggerhead is a name for hardack or ironwood. I said, that's supposed to be strong and tough and that. And I said, they were insulted because they didn't like the thing of it. I said, like it's inferring to them, I said, I don't know how many years I've been in there, and what state helped in the north here, did they more to help the slaves and that up through into Canada than upper New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, up through there, all these up there.
Well, the other thing there too is, there's a Nigger Hill near where I live, and it was because there was a black family that lived there, and in those days, the term was...
Yeah, it's a common name for it.
And that was... So in a sense, it is a memory as well.
Mm-hmm.
And tells you something about... well, like I was asking about Pigeon Hollow.
Yeah, they clean right out, you know. I don't know where the Jim Flaxley name comes from, but there's a lot of that, like down in Brandville Woods, puddled off and all that.
Yes, and Codfish Corners.
What?
Codfish Corners.
Oh, yeah.
Never heard of that one.
That was down in Granville.
I don't know. That used to have a...
And it was Puddle Dock.
That's the middle of Granville Woods.
And that was because it was a loading...
I don't know. It's just about... It's pretty close to where the White River goes down one way and the Mad River comes the other way. middle of riding along in there, that section somewhere. I probably know a lot more about it than I did. Then they used to have the road haulers, you know, down through Granville. You heard of that?
Yes.
You ever see a picture of it?
I did, yeah.
They claimed the fellow riding steering that sled in the front. It must have had more nerves than brains, because they said that was the most dangerous job you could ever think of.
Well, it was called, actually going down, it was called Hay Hill, because they...
One section of it used to put a lot of hay on, try to keep them from just sliding on that track. And they used to go up thousands of feet of logs. Sterling's brother, when he was a young fellow, he's a big, rugged fellow, about 6 foot four. And I remember Sterling telling him when he was young that their barn is a lot like Willie's on that side hill up the very end there. And every floor, you go in every floor from the ground. And where you come from the section where the cattle were, the feed floor in it, they had a drum of syrup, a 55-gallon drum, and the syrup was 11 pounds to a gallon. And the drum, I think empty drum, those days weighed about 90 pounds. And Sterling said he went to try to lift up one end of it, and his brother reached over and pulled it up one hand. And when they come ready, put it in the wagon, backed up, and it was the wagon was probably as high as his shelf above the floor when he backed up the thing. And my cousin reached down, pulled that part up, and rolled it in. And I figured up in my head one time, I think it was over 700 pounds. But when he got older, he had a head injury. He was doing janitor work for a lot of the apartment houses out in Barrie, and he struck a head on a pipe or something. And he never spoke well after that. But and he got, you know, more feeble. But I think Cluston would tell you that his father, Roy Irish, and another, somebody else, I don't remember the fellow's name, been trying to roll over a big log that cut in the woods. And a cousin come along, he had a special can up over his shoulder, carrying it, walking down through, and he met him, and they hollered at him and said, "Hey, will you help give us a hand?" "Sure." So they said they went to can hook up, and he stuck his in and gave a heave and rolled the log over, and the two of them hadn't been able to roll it over before.
Gosh.
And they used to tell about it.
Well, there were a lot of strong men were really admired, yeah. And there were a number of stories about there was a guy that carried a barrel of flour home four miles.
Oh, yeah, that was Paul. Well, I know that Paul Vianz, that was the Gregory Vianz, used to be road commissioner here in Faiston. His brother lived down in Moortown, and he used to go through just where the iron bridge is out of Moortown and cut up across. The road goes, turns, you know, goes up in there. They said he used to carry, put 100 grain on his back and carry it up the hill to when he lived in the farm up there. And Gregor Van told me about it one time. He said, "I thought my brother could do it, I'd do it." He said, "I carried it up." And he said, "And then I shook for a week."
This was Paul Vienz that used to do that?
Yeah. And he later bought a farm right there. He was trying to go up North Facing Road, right there in the corner. And, the father, he was pretty strong for his size. Never weighed more than 170, I don't think.
Gosh.
We lived up there at Harmer, and Merle Johnson lives now. They had a Monty car, front wheels off it, in the shed there, and they pulled it out, and Otto, the one I was telling you about, so strong, had to grow up the team, had one bunk sled, just getting logs out. They're going to move the car, so they use that for woodshed, it's in where the shed was. So while I drove up, before he got off, Father reached down and picked that front end of that Model T up and swung around, sat in the bunk. My cousin, Matter and Hornet, he said, "Why did you wait till I got to it?" I couldn't even budget. I don't think I could budget my best day.
Incredible.
And Father's 15 years old. He did all the farming here one year and still went to school. He'd get up daylight or before daylight, worked to the last bell. And at the first bell, he'd get down in time for the last bell. When it come noon, he'd run up and haul up another load of manure with all by hand and get down by the last bell at noon and back working that. He did that one spring.
When he went down here?
Yeah.
Right down here at the corner where our son built his house.
Yeah.
Gosh.
There's 18 pupils there, just around on this section of the thing, beside the teacher. And Father had a little house down on what's called Loop Road, just a little white house with a he built with a white picket fence around it. And I was there one time, just as I was leaving, a car drove in and almost spoke. My father did. She ran in the back seat. She was quite an old lady. My father's up. Must have been early 70s. And got talking, and I left right afterwards. But she'd been his teacher down here, and I think her name was Mrs. Ross, or Russell.
Oh, good job.
Taught down here. They all had big families. The next family over was a Smales place. And my
was
grandmother,
the Smales?
It was a Smales place. That's where Jack Reynolds lives now. And he moved it back, the house back from the road. The house there was just about like ours, right beside the road. He moved it back about 100 feet or more. And they lost the whole family to TB. The only one that lived was the father, Jack Smales. They had two or three daughters. I know there was two, and I think there was three, and a boy, and the mother all died of TB. And the old man, he went down, he was Carl Long's father-in-law, Carl, married one of the girls, and they had a boy. He was about 12 years old. He was over in the mill and lost a finger. They took him to hospital up in Montpelier, and something they didn't do right anyway, he died. He was just 12.
Oh.
And Carl lost his wife, and the boy is just a baby or a small child. And my grandmother was pretty upset with that because she thought about the little boy. And she kept house. Like I said, Carl Long's the, it was Carl Long's father-in-law. She kept house for him, and he was in the front rooms in the old hotel to cut hair. Well, he's a lot better farmer than he, I don't, than it was Bob as a barber. I don't know how good a farmer was. I remember I used to get my hair cut there, and I always left a piece of ear or something with him every time he did it.
Gosh. Well, he also ran the general store, didn't he, Carl? No.
Carl Long did, but this Smales, Jack Smales, it called. All he did after that was a little barber, but he was lame too, if I remember right.
And he lost his wife and his son, just.
And his daughters.
Oh.
All to TB.
Gosh, well.
And my father grew up with him.
Mm.
You know, he knew him.
There was certainly hardship. Guy Everett, the farmer over here, was talking about how
Everett Palmer
lost a brother to infantile paralysis, mm-hmm. and he remembered his mother saying, "Gosh, do you think they're all gonna get it?"
Mm-hmm.
Fletcher Johnson's brother, Clifford, was crippled from polio. Yeah.
I guess there was a real epidemic here.
Oh yes. Yeah.
Which you don't think about anymore.
Mm. And there in the other room, I was talking with Albert, Albert Kingsbury. He's been dead for a number of years. He and one of my uncle, John Livingston, is named after his father. They come along with the young fellows, and they just put new floor in there. Yeah, but it's not there now.
Not there anymore.
They had a maple board,
mm-hmm.
and a birch board.
It was
and
a
they alternated
them
in a different color. And the day they got them in, they were, I guess they'd been working in wood or something. They come along and see a new floor, and one of them said, "Well, we ought to break that floor in." So I said, "The wood." So one of them, I think, bought the oysters, and the other got the crackers. It was cross crackers, I guess it was. For an oyster supper, and they went around, sent word around the neighbors, and said that that night it was 60 people here that for break the floor in.
Well,
kitchen junket, you used to call them.
Yeah, well, now that was.
It had to be around 1900 or earlier, probably around 1900.
When they broke in the floor.
Yeah, we come on the floors, the house been empty, everything was smashed out, windows and doors and everything.
When we got
vandalized.
It.
Vandalized. And so we fixed them up some.
Well, you
and
were
the floor was always warped.
Oh.
And I tried to get it down. I tried everything, but then so much moisture and stuff, and I never do it. Finally, I had to rip it up. And I put the subfloor in, and this a spruce plane matched underneath it. And that linoleum was only 44 years old.
Something like that.
Well, we, it was 29 years before we got it down. So you see, things didn't start out too good. Her well, folks bought it for us for a Christmas present the first year we were married.
First year
we were married. Yep. Sat there by the chimney for, I think, 29 years.
So when were you married?
In 47.
47. Well, you were saying that, that this kitchen here was three rooms.
Oh.
Tell me that again.
Well, this was a summer kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they call
and
it.
And the petition went through here, and the other petition to come up here, and that made one room. And then where the refrigerator was, there's a petition there with a door. That's where the water bar was, and they had a water running full pipe and out all the time. The spring was only about 300 feet from the road.
Yep, across the road.
And you can go up there and put your hand in that spring, and I guarantee you, get, if you put it in there for 5 minutes, you spend the next 20 minutes or half hour trying to thaw your hand out. So I said, if anybody ever interfered with that spring, it was going to be war. I didn't care who it was. But the state, all those, they want to drill the wells now.
Well, you still use the spring gun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but
we don't have a well.
But they that's what they would like to do. If you tell them you got to drill a well, there's no trouble. My boy built his house down here, and he's going to tap in the spring I got with the other place, and that's pretty good water, too. They couldn't do that.
We have a spring, and we sent the water up, and they told us it was contaminated.
Yeah.
But there isn't a house, you know.
Well, I had a fellow tell me how they tested it down there, if it was down in the state here. And I had a cousin tell me that he had his tested private outfit over in New Hampshire, and it cost him $150. But he says, you want to do it, you go with that. He said, you don't go with what the state is.
Yeah, well,
he says, you want to get took. He says, you want to just try to do it here in the state of Vermont.
Well, you know, Pat had to have that tested again a while ago.
Oh, yeah.
So he went up and they told him, you know, something about putting Clorox in the water, you know, so long before you take a sample. That's what he did. Came back perfect.
Oh, no kidding.
Well, I knew a fellow, his son bought a big farm up in Kirby. And or his nephew, I guess it's his nephew, and he decided that he had a well instead of a spring, but he decided to send a sample in. So he sent it in and told him where he got it. They sent back and said the turtle's contaminated. He had to do this and that, so he did all the things required and sent it back in. They come back, it wasn't much of any improvement. So he took another sample and sent it in, didn't tell him where he got it. Come back, it was perfect. It was as pure water that it was as pure as any water they'd ever had.
Yeah, well, my husband's comment was it must be partridge droppings,
right?
Yeah, well, that's the same era. Well, anyway, the boy was going to tap into our spring. I said, well, he couldn't do it. He couldn't go in there. I forget what the reason was. He had to have that. And so had to get an engineer, and they drew it up. And they got all done, they fixed the other spring about 30 feet below where that one was. So, you got around, you run the pipe right up into my spring, and everything is all right. This is a big spring, and I only got a couple trailers and two houses going off it. It's got a big storage thing. But it cost him all that to go through it. And they never come back. And somebody told him after, so if they ask, if you're going to build, just tell me you're going to drill well and forget all about it. So, I don't know. Well, we got out here in Montpelier, is that right? All we've got is all our politicians and that, even bureaucrats, they're all carpetbaggers. They come up here and they get in office a little while, and if they can get a job somewhere else, a little bit more money, all right. Otherwise, it's here. And I still think they should have a representative from every town like they used to have. They've got the Senate and senators. They get the way it is now, something like Burlington and Rutland can control the whole state on everything. And they're all outlanders. They say about flatlanders, I call them outlanders. And I said that the way it is now, I can figure that the state of Vermont is like the South was after the Civil War, with all the carpetbaggers and that coming in. And, well, the state's control. You go down to We haven't gone to town meeting for years, or at least I haven't.
I went last year. I don't know if I'll go this year.
You used to go down, you really had something for a town meeting dinner and that. Well, it's something
no
different
more.
Today. And you go down there, and if you're a native, they treat you almost like a town idiot. They don't come right out and say it, you know, but I got hard and read faces some. But that's the way it, you know, you get the impression.
Oh, you used to be able to go to town meeting, you know, and you'd have a lot of fun, you know, sitting there listening to them argue back and forth. They need to get some knockdown drag out sometimes.
Well, I was thinking about the ones out in Montpelier, you know. They cut it way down on the representatives, you know, they're supposed to carry according to them. In the first year they cut it all down, their expenses is just as high to run legislature as it was when they had 100 more, I guess it was. I can't remember just how many it used to be. I haven't checked it out. And now they run clear into May or June. They'd like to get it year round, so they have a year round job. Someone, they would be up holding the job anyway.
Yeah. One thing I was going to ask you about, I've heard a number of times about the landslide. I guess it was back around 1898 or.
Yeah, I think you can just see a little strip of it now. Most all it. It's right over there and toward the top of the mountain, you see one way over, you see one little place that looked kind of bare.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where it went. It went right down through into that hollow there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite a big one. And somewhere, I think the folks used to have a picture.